I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. Bree's also a video podcast producer, TV host, and father. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is MakerBot?
So a MakerBot is a machine that can make you anything. It's a replicator. So let's say you want something, you can imagine it and design it, or maybe somebody else has made it and you can download it, and then you just print it out. So say you need a bottle opener, you just print one out, and then you're opening bottles.
It's made out of plastic that feels kind of like Legos. What kind of plastic is it?
Well, there's two kinds of plastic you can use in a MakerBot right now, and we're exploring more. We're looking for more things to print with. But you can use ABS or PLA. ABS is a really common plastic. It's what most of the plastic you have in your life is made out of. It's like it's the same thing that Lego's made out of. PLA is another plastic we use, and it's made from corn, and it is biodegradable, and when you make things out of it, it smells like waffles.
3D printers have been around for decades, but they are very expensive and hundreds of thousands of dollars and huge, but your printers cost roughly $1,300. What was the impetus for wanting to create a cheaper 3D printer?
Well, we really wanted one, and they were really expensive. And so we just used the materials we had at hand and the tools we had at hand. We have a laser cutter that we share, and we just kept trying. So we locked ourselves up in our hackerspace with literally two cases of ramen and a lot of Club Mate, which is a caffeinated beverage. And we basically just camped out there making prototype after prototype. And we'd been working all through the night for days.
What was the first object you made with your 3D printer when it finally worked?
Oh, we promptly printed out a shot glass and had drinks.
You promptly printed out a shot glass and then hopped on a plane to South by Southwest, which is a leading technology innovative conference in Austin. What did South by Southwest lead to, if anything, for you?
Well, you know, we had made 20 kits for people to have their own 3D printer. And we thought, okay, we'll sell 10, and then we'll have 10 to sell next month. And then, of course, we sold those, like, really quickly. Like, within 2 weeks, we had sold out of the thing we thought would take 2 months to sell. So the race was on.
Who buys these 3D machines?
You know, the people who buy 3D printers are a real mix, because you've got some, you know, you've got the obvious kind of engineers, hackers, programmer types that get them. And then you've got just ordinary people who live in the future who want to have a machine that can make anything so that when they need something, they don't have to go to the store. They can just print it out and have it.
It takes a little while for you to kind of get your hands around exactly what it is we're talking about. Maybe it's my failure of imagination, but it took me some time to actually understand, okay, well, this is a printer not producing ink, but actually making stuff.
Yeah, it's a replicator. It replicates your ideas into real objects. It makes things, your ideas, real. And, you know, we're used to being consumers. We're used to, you know, if we want a clock, we think, okay, well, where do I go shop for that? Mm-hmm. When you have a MakerBot, the world's different. You see the world through MakerBot glasses. You can actually print out glasses. But when you have a MakerBot, you think, okay, I need a clock. Well, maybe I'll MakerBot one. And in fact, a group of folks actually did collaborate, and they made a grandfather clock mechanism that's just beautiful and ticks and everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open source robots that make plastic objects. You grew up in Ithaca, New York, and then moved to Seattle, Washington. What was your home life like? What did your parents do, for example?
You know, my dad is, he's a marketer. His website is brand.com, so he's been doing it for a while. And my mom does a bunch of stuff, including art.
How did you become interested in making things or tinkering? Do you have early experiences of just being very hands-on?
You know, I got into tinkering when I went to go visit my Aunt Meredith, who at that time was married to a guy named Joe. And Joe, his job was every morning he'd wake up and I'd get into his pickup truck with him at like 4 in the morning in Boston. He knew all the trash routes. And we'd go on the trash routes before the trash men came. And we'd pick out all the good stuff. And then during the week, during the day, he would fix that stuff up and on the weekend sell it at a flea market. And that week, we picked up a couple bikes that were broken and put them together. And he made me feel like I knew, like he let me put things together and figure out how it worked so that at the end, it was really my bike. I'd put that bike together, even though I was like 7.
By the way, where does the name Bree come from?
So my name Bree is short for Bree Huspety, and it comes from my parents, who were hippies at the time. Their yogi gave me that name.
Your parents were not in the technology field at all, but your grandfather was. He also made machines. What kind of work did he do?
So my grandpa had a company called High Speed Checkware in Ithaca. His company made machines that would weigh things really quickly. So when Morton salt comes down the production line in long lines of circular tubes, his machine would be on the line, and it would quickly weigh things. And if there wasn't enough salt in one of the containers, it would knock it off. So he made machines that would weigh things at a high speed.
When you were growing up in Seattle, you know, Bill Gates, Microsoft was pretty big. Did that have any impact on your, you know, your thinking at all?
You know, Microsoft is something I had friends whose parents worked at Microsoft, and Bill Gates moved into the neighborhood. And I don't know so much one of the things that did affect me is I had a friend who worked at Nintendo, and Paul Scavlin had a job where his job was to play games all day. He was a tester, and then later on he was a game counselor, because back in those days you could call, if you didn't mind paying long distance, you could call up Nintendo and talk to somebody and be like, I can't get through this level, and they'd be like, go find the magic hammer and hit it, this wall with it, mm-hmm, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And that was his job. And I remember thinking, oh, that's such a, you know, that's a job that somebody does, like that exists in the world, like mm-hmm. there's not just like you're going to be a doctor or a nurse or a farmer or something like this. There's people who play games for a living. I thought, okay, anything can happen.
How much was the notion of you're having to make a living, how large did that loom in your career choices, for example?
For me, in terms of my career, I've always felt really strongly to, you know, follow my heart. I read, you know, the whole Joseph Campbell Power of Myth series and was very inspired to follow my passion. And so you don't go into teaching to make money. I think after 7 years, I was making about $31,000 a year. But I was there because I wanted to create infrastructure for people to make things, to learn how to be creative. And that's been a thread through my whole life, the idea of creating infrastructure for people to be creative and being creative.
You've been a public school teacher, but what was your own education like?
You know, it was mixed. I mean, I dropped out of middle school because I just didn't want to go, and I was having to face bullies and get into fights all the time. So I just dropped out of seventh grade and was happy to do so. And then, you know, later on, I realized, like, okay, school, fine. I see how this works. I have to do this to make other things happen. Basically, I kind of got back into school when I was, like, a sophomore, and I realized, okay, I'll jump through the hoops to make sure I can make something else happen. And then I got lucky, and I ended up going to the Evergreen State College, which is is a liberal arts college in Olympia, Washington, where there are no requirements except that you have to have X amount of credits before you can graduate. So you can study anything. I studied everything from political science and history to education and ethnomusicology and mythology and psychology, and ended up doing dance for 2 years and being in a samba band and playing gamelan. And so I was able to just continually explore different kinds of things and try different things out.
You talk about dropping out of school in seventh grade. So you're 12 years old. What does that mean? Like, you wake up in the morning and what do you do?
You know, as a kid, when you go to school and you're the first 6 months of school are full of intimidation and bullying, you just find a way to not go. You just wake up and you think, I'm not going.
Where'd you go? What'd you do?
I just stayed at home and read books.
What did your parents say?
It didn't matter. I wasn't going.
But what did they say?
I don't remember.
So they didn't have much choice.
No, I wasn't going.
What was the experience like for you of being an elementary school teacher in the public school system in Seattle? Was it creative as you had hoped?
As a teacher, I got to be the art teacher, which is one of the last places you're actually not bound by teaching to the test in American public schools. And so I got to teach kids how to make things, how to sew a button. Most kids don't know how to sew a button if they lose a button. They don't know how to put it back. So there's kind of basic skills like that that are really satisfying and make young people feel really independent. But the bureaucracy and the underfundedness of schools these days means that really there's not enough resources to do to be effective as a teacher and with 32 kids in a classroom. It eventually wears you down. After being a school teacher for 7 years, I can honestly say, like, if you can, drop out of school. If you're somebody who can follow your passion and try things out and develop infrastructure for yourself, if you have that kind of discipline, find other ways to learn things.
So here you were, a frustrated art teacher, and you said, okay, I'm going to move to Brooklyn. Talk to me about that moment.
So there were a couple things that happened. I had come to New York on vacation, and I had seen some video art at an art gallery. And I said, this is neat. I want one. How much is this artwork? And they said, well, a DVD is $15,000. And I had that kind of like Picasso moment of like, yeah, I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I made a video, and that was an art video called the I Love You Project. And I took it around to galleries in Seattle, and I said, here's my video. I'm ready to display it. And they all liked it. But after, a month or two, it had been seen by like 4 people, and nothing had happened. So I was like, screw this. I'm putting it on the internet. And sure enough, after like a few months, like 50,000 people had watched it. And I was like, okay, that's more than Phil's Mariners Stadium, But I like this. I like this kind of attention. So I started making more videos. I made videos for my students. Next thing you know, I'm making videos for Make Magazine. Then I moved to New York, and where I continued to work on making videos for Make Magazine, worked for Etsy for a bit, and then quit that to start MakerBot.
Etsy being the online marketplace for handmade items. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. We'll hear more from Bree coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes 3D printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. You've been willing to expose yourself, your private life, to some extent, publicly, using the internet.
Sure.
And you've been blogging since 2004. And I'd love for you to read one of your blogs from 2004. It's entitled Dream. Okay.
Okay.
You're laughing. Why are you laughing?
You got me. Okay. So here we go. So I've been blogging for a long time. I actually had a blog in '99, but it was anonymous, and I ended up erasing it. It's this idea of sharing what you're thinking. Okay. And then I got at one point in 2004, I was like, okay, I'm just gonna share everything, including my dreams. So I just woke up from a dream that involved going to the transmission shop, driving to a farm owned by my brother, enjoying the farm, and then falling from a pulley cable slide. My brother was played by Tom Hanks, and when I fell, I began screaming incoherently, and I was paralyzed with a plastic sword in each hand. Even though I was screaming inside, I knew the tragedy because I would die, and I would miss out on marrying the love of my life, and I would miss my brother, and all the things I want to do would never be done. Tom Hanks carried me through 3 feet deep of water, and I was still screaming in my dream as I woke up. My dream reflected a few things to me. First of all, I love my brother and I love having a brother. Secondly, I touched on a deep sadness in me. I've experienced loss and I can touch that sadness in myself. I've been having a lot of dreams lately. Feels like a time of change in my life. My modus operandi has been to go with the flow and accept the events and things that come to me in life and nurture those opportunities. I've changed a little now in that I am searching to build something. I'm searching for a path that I can set out on. No more hitchhiking through life. I want to drive my own train.
How do you feel reading that now?
You know, one of the nice things about having a blog is that you're leaving, you leave breadcrumbs for yourself to say, like, okay, this is where I'm at now. And so I can see then in 2004, I wanted to start making things happen more. I wanted to be like, okay, let's do things. You know, I think this is a little bit of a moment where you can see, like, okay, I wanted something, but I didn't know what. It took me a few years to get to a place where I'm quite happy driving things.
You talk about being deeply sad. What made you deeply sad at that point in your life?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure.
What is your feeling about, you know, sharing your personal life and
So when I first started making videos, I was video blogger, like, number 13 in this early crew of video bloggers. And I was making videos for my students, and I was making personal videos, and I was sharing them. And we grew this community of, like, 25 or 30 people. And we were just making videos that were like, let me show you my apartment. Mm-hmm. And people weren't doing this at the time. So it felt like, okay, we're in this club of people who are sharing, you know, look at what my cat did today. And it sounds kind of silly to say today because YouTube is just absurdly full of this kind of stuff. But back then, it really felt like we're breaking new ground. We're finding new ways to share. And sharing is really important to me. It's one of those things where, if you are not somebody who shares, you should be, because there's a future out there that is sadder if you don't. We're in a nice time where just in the past few years, sharing has become something that has value. You know, and even if you just share stories about how you dealt with something or how you got your baby to sleep at night or whatever, it means you're leaving breadcrumbs for other people so they won't feel as alone, so that when they go to learn how to do something, they can build on what you did and take it to the next level.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers that produce plastic objects. You moved to Brooklyn in 2007, and prior to starting MakerBot, you were one of the creators of NYC Resistor, which is a hacker collective, which allows people to tinker with software and technology. But the word hacker kind of has this negative connotation that, like, you're invading somebody else's technology. What was the purpose of this hacker collective in Brooklyn?
So NYC Resistor is a really special place. You enter it, and there's a laser cutter. There's a big table where there's lots of people working on their laptops. There's soldering irons where people are assembling electronics. And there's, you know, all sorts of tools and materials. A member of NYC Resistor can make anything. Our motto is, we learn, share, and make things. When people think about hacker, a lot of times they think about, like, oh, somebody's breaking into my computer. But I believe a hacker is somebody who's got a special enthusiasm for figuring out how things work and using them in special ways. An example of somebody who, when we first started, we came out, our first model 3D printer was the Cupcake. It was inexpensive, it worked, and it was great. But it was our first machine, so there was a lot of room for improvement. Because we shared all the designs, people could hack on it. They could improve it. And they did. They built all these crazy adaptations. They took the Z stage, which is the part that goes up and down. They ripped the back off it. They put their own one on. And they could do that because they could print out replacement parts that improved the machine. Mm-hmm. And every time this happened, we celebrated it. We were like, cool. This person found a way of taking what we did and improving on it, mm-hmm. and sharing back with the community.
You met Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer, your co-founders of MakerBot, at NYC Resistor, and you decided you wanted to make a go of this as a company, and you raised $75,000 from friends and family initially, and that $75,000 turned into $5 million of revenue. Were you surprised by the level of demand for this?
Yeah, I mean, we started it off and we were like, okay, this, when we started, we kind of fooled ourselves thinking, yeah, we'll just start this. This will be something we do. Maybe we'll do other stuff too. And then as soon as we sold the first 20 in no time flat, we were like, okay, now we got to make more. Mm-hmm. And so we spent that first 3 months prototyping and getting ready. And then we launched our product. Then we spent the next like 9 or 10 months just figuring out how to pack and ship and put labels on things and count out nuts and bolts and stuff like this.
How were you supporting yourself at the time financially?
Oh, we were broke. We weren't paying ourselves. Every time we got, you know, money, we were spending it on robot parts. I skipped rent 1 month just because I didn't have it. We're a committed group. We were really into it.
To what extent did being broke scare you?
Well, being broke sucks. It means you can't take your girlfriend out to dinner, and it's pretty stressful. But it, you know, to counter that, we knew we were onto something, and we had to ride it as hard as we could and push it as hard as we could so we can get as many of them out there and change the world.
You talk about being broke while you were trying to get the company off the ground, and it was hard to not be able to take your girlfriend out to dinner. Your girlfriend at the time became your eventual partner and the mother of your child. How did you meet Keo Stark?
We met playing Werewolf, which is a game where you try and use deceit and lying to survive in a town of werewolves. And this is a real-life game. It's not online. And together you are a village, and you have to figure out – and there's werewolves in the village. And you have to figure out who they are, except you don't know who they are because they look like people. So you have to figure out who's lying.
Was either of you a werewolf?
Absolutely not. We were both villagers. I met Keo, and we were talking about trying to effectively lie, trying to come up with strategies for that, and Keo's a horrible liar. And so that was a nice way to kind of start with an honest moment about deception, I guess.
Is there a community of werewolf players out there somewhere?
Werewolf is one of those games that's gotten popular on like conferences. Mm-hmm. So after the conference, you'll get like 10 or 12, 15 people together and a bunch of drinks, and you'll sit around and lie to each other, see if you can figure out who's lying.
Keo is an author, and she recently wrote a novel called Follow Me Down. She's also written a manual, a handbook called Don't Go Back to School.
Keo did a lot of interviews with people to figure out how they learned things without going to school. Mm-hmm. So it's all about how to learn things without having to pay for it.
You've created with Keo a manifesto of sorts called The Cult of Done. How do you live your life, or how do you express this cult of done?
There's some things like, you know, if you have an idea and you don't execute it within a week, throw it away. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Abandon it. Then there's things like done is the engine of more. So when you finish something, it means you can do more. So finish more things so you can start more things. Another one is like everything is a rough draft. Don't strive for perfection. Just get it to a place where you're satisfied.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open-source robots that make plastic objects. MakerBot's 3D printers produce objects used for designing, recreation, and practical life. So things like bathtub plugs, shower curtain rings, bottle openers. A MakerBot printer costs roughly $1,300. I want to talk some more about the varied applications of some of the objects that MakerBot produces.
Sure.
For instance, somebody made an engagement ring out of a MakerBot machine. What's that story?
So there's a guy named Finnflood, and he was going to Iceland the next day with his sweetie. And he thought, you know, it's Friday night, and he thought, maybe this would be a great time. This would be a beautiful place. Maybe I'll find a beautiful place to go and pop the question. But I need a ring, and it's late. And I'm leaving tomorrow. So he popped around to his local hackerspace and printed one out, and they went to Iceland, and he gave it to her, and she said yes. And it's a really nice story because it means, like, you can have a MakerBot and print out anything, really.
That's one small example, but do you have, like, a larger mission or hope for the company? I mean, here's somebody who makes, you know, an engagement ring, but what does this look like on a larger scale? Or it might just be like you just want people to make stuff.
Well, when we started, we saw those first 20 machines and we thought, okay, here's potential energy. This is going out there and people are going to use these machines to make anything they want. And now that we've got, goodness, 7,000 machines are out in the wild right now, 7,000 MakerBots, we're seeing what people are doing. Every day there's new things that people are making. You know, they're making cookie cutters, they're making robots, they're making characters, they're making remote control cars. The thing that's getting me excited these days is what will we do together? What can 7,000 MakerBots in the world do? One of the projects we're working on right now is called Project Shelter. We're making shells for hermit crabs because hermit crabs are facing a housing shortage. So we're helping them.
What's wrong with the shells of hermit crabs now?
Hermit crabs don't make their own shells. And humans take them away from the beach. And the snails that make the shells that hermit crabs like are not producing as many shells. So they're doing things like sticking their butts in bottles and sticking their butts in shotgun shells and stuff like this. And that's just wrong. People have uploaded different designs for shells because hermit crabs are kind of picky. And it works. The community collectively are solving an ecological problem.
What are other examples?
When Deepwater Horizon, the catastrophe that happened in the Gulf where they were drilling and oil was just flooding into the Gulf, the Thingiverse community rallied together to try and figure out, okay, what's the problem? How can we help? I'm really curious as the community grows to see what will, not just what will one printer do, but what will 7,000 printers and their users do to change the world together.
What is the Thingiverse?
Thingiverse is a universe of things. It's a place to share your digital designs. So you can, if you design something, say you design a new type of bottle opener, you can upload it and share it and everybody can benefit.
Another project that you've worked on in the past is an art project where you exhibited works of art made by MakerBot at the New Museum in New York City. Talk to me about that project.
Yes.
This was a project that you did with Zach Lieberman.
Yeah. So Zach Lieberman and I went to Tompkins Square Park and we took strangers and we set them down and we asked them to tell them who are the important people in your life. Immediately it got good when people talk to you about who they care about and share the people who are important to them. They get emotional. And we caught that on video and we caught that with a 3D scanner. And then we printed out miniature heads about 4 inches tall of the people who had done this. And then we projected images of them talking on it. So in some ways, it was kind of like, you know that moment in Star Wars where Princess Leia goes, "Help me, Obi-Wan. You're my only hope." And she's in 3D and she's projected. It was kind of like that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes 3D printers. Speaking of the important people in your life, you became a father in 2011, and in the spirit of sharing your life on the internet, you talked about the hardship that you faced when your daughter was born prematurely, and she was in the NICU for a couple of months. You blogged or wrote about one particular incident when she was in the NICU and no one was paying attention.
Yeah.
Can you describe that experience briefly?
So, hospitals suck. The internet hasn't arrived to hospitals, and the way that data gets transferred at hospitals is people work 12 hours because they're two 12-hour shifts, and then they stay a little bit longer than their 12 hours because the next person comes on shift, and they share everything that they've done in the last 12 hours the most with the next person, and that's the way that data transfer happens in a hospital. So I had a baby named Nika, and she was born 7 weeks early, which is really early, and she was 2.5 pounds. So she had to go to the NICU, which is where they put babies in little boxes and watch them. And the second night I came back, because they don't let you be there from, I think it's 8 to 9, because that's their transition time where they're expected to share the data. And I arrived at 9, and the monitors were flatlined, which means there's no heartbeat, no breathing, no oxygen. And I was like, okay, before I completely freak out, I'm just going to check. And so I went over and I checked her pulse and I checked her breathing and she was breathing and there was a pulse. And I started looking at, and I looked at the monitor, and it was clear it hadn't been hooked up for 2 hours. Hmm. And so I asked the nurse, I said, you know, this is why my baby hasn't been hooked up for 2 hours. And rather than saying, oh, I'm sorry, let me fix this right now, this is horrible, she proceeded to make excuses about how overworked they were, how the technology isn't reliable, how the backup systems hadn't been effect, and how hard it was to find good people.
Making excuses.
Making lots of excuses. And if she had just said, I'm going to fix this right now, would have been fine. But making excuses meant that these, you know, four layers of redundancy had all failed, and I was the only one who'd noticed it. And I'm sure parents who are listening can imagine, you know, when you trust your baby to someone else and they don't let you be there. I was just, I got really mad.
Anything that a MakerBot could fix?
You know what, though? When I was in the NICU, I was there for 6 weeks and I basically camped out there. And I, you know, I looked at all the technology there. The isolette, which is the box that the baby's in, that also has a bunch of hookups and stuff like this for it, and has air that you can pump in. You know, that costs like a lot of money, like $75,000 for that box. And I'm thinking, okay, I could do that for three and maintain all the functionality.
$3,000.
Yeah. What I did in my 6 weeks of the NICU was just sit there and reverse engineer all the stuff in the hospital, thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe they pay this much for it.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota, and so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly. And it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom, mm-hmm. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey. Mm-hmm.
So
then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily. I didn't know where my meals were going to come from.
where I would get money to buy clothes from, and you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina,
mm-hmm.
who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.